Heavenly Father, today we put on the full armor to protect us against attack. We put on the belt of truth to protect against lies and deception. We put on the breastplate of righteousness to protect our hearts from the temptations. We put the gospel of peace on our feet to walk in your light, peace, and freedom with the Holy Spirit. We rebuke anxious thoughts. We take up your shield of faith for protection to block and destroy all the darts and threats thrown at us by the enemy. We put on the helmet of salvation to cover our minds and thoughts, reminding us that we are children of a mighty King. We are forgiven, set free, saved by the blood of Jesus. We take up the sword of the Spirit, your living word, that has the power to demolish strongholds and is sharper than any double-edged sword. We come to you, Lord, in prayer daily. In Jesus' mighty name we pray. Amen. What's up, you guys? Welcome to The Imagination. I'm your host, Emma, and today I'm honored to have on the show entrepreneur, founder, and executive director of Relentless Hope, certified victims advocate, survivor ally, Utah whistleblower, and passionate pursuer of truth, Cindy Metcalf. Cindy is the founder and executive director of Relentless Hope, an anti-trafficking organization in Salt Lake City. She's been working with ritual abuse survivors since 2018, and in that time, Cindy has heard some of the most horrific stories of abuse. Relentless Hope are a team of passionate advocates who provide support and resources for survivors. They also work on criminal and civil cases for clients. 90% of the clients seen by Relentless Hope were abused within the LDS Church, but they know this is happening in many church denominations across America. Cindy and Relentless Hope serve to educate the public and legislators in order to change laws, fight for justice, raise awareness, and get the resources for their clients needed to heal. Cindy is a certified victims advocate who works with lawyers, law enforcement, media, and healthcare professionals for the benefit of ritual abuse survivors. She volunteers 100% of her time to this cause because she believes that ritual abuse is the most sadistic form of torture on the earth. In Cindy's own words, quote, children need to be protected, justice must be served, unquote. I was interested in having Cindy on for a variety of reasons, and one of those reasons is because I have such a deep admiration for Cindy, who stepped into a role that she didn't have to step into. So many of you on the other side of the screen reach out to me feeling helpless, wondering what you can do now that you know the hard truths of the world. And although I can't answer that question for all of you, what I can do is bring you people who have found an answer to that question in hopes that it can inspire you. Cindy is a hero for stepping into an advocacy role for survivors, and I'm just as excited as all of you to learn from her. One of the other reasons I'm excited to have Cindy on is because I get a lot of requests about having more discussions around the LDS Church, and Cindy has been right in the thick of it, right in the heart of Utah, where she's been risking her life at times to discover the network of corruption that is committing crimes against children in Utah. Her work and research is incredibly thorough and non-biased, as Cindy is not a Mormon, and you can feel and see her deep passion for helping survivors in her testimony. I am honored to have Cindy on and ask that all of you please give her your full attention as we dive deep into some new topics. Before I finish introducing today's guest, I wanted to give just a couple reminders and updates. If you'd like to on the podcast as a guest or share any information privately with me, you can email me at imaginabetterworld2020@gmail.com. You can also use this email if you'd like to be a part of my new book series featuring written survivor testimonies, and you can find the video with all the details on how to submit your testimony on any of my podcast channels. And lastly, I'd love your support on my Substack, where I've taken up investigative journalism as an outlet for me to share about the podcast, guests, and my advocacy work. And you can subscribe to me there at www.emmacatherine.substack.com. All my links are in the show notes, and I'd love your support across all platforms. Thank you all for caring so deeply about survivors and whistleblowers and for helping to make The Imagination the safest space on the internet for survivor and whistleblower disclosures. So you guys, please help me in welcoming today's guest of honor, hero for the children, survivor and victim advocate, miracle worker, creator, voice for the voiceless, selfless servant, independent researcher, and a warrior woman who is creating and giving relentless hope to survivors all over the country and soon the world. The one, the only, Cindy Metcalf. Cindy, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you for inviting me on your podcast, Emma. I am honored to speak to your audience. That was quite a raving review. So, thank you. I hope I can live up to that.
And more. You're amazing. I have such a deep admiration for people. I mean, anybody, survivors speaking up to you. But so many people in society just look away from this. And I'm so fascinated by the people that see the fire and run into it, thinking, who's burning? Where most people are like, get me away from the fire. I don't want to get hurt. You know, there's these two different mindsets. And I love that you ran into the fire when presented with really hard information and that you didn't look away. So I thought, if it's okay with you, I would love to know how you got into this work and what you did before you ended up being passionate about helping the children.
Well, so I've been through many tracks in my career. I first started out in marketing and advertising, and I worked for corporations for about 13 years. Then I took time off to raise my son. And when he was old enough, I wanted to get back into work. So when he was in school full time, then I decided to start volunteering at different nonprofit organizations. And so eventually I came to work for an organization. I can't say their name, but they're a polygamy rescue organization here in Utah, and they're pretty well known. And so when I was listening to the clients coming in, they were telling their stories. They would tell us some of the most horrific things that have ever happened to them. And I recognized it as ritual abuse. And so as I got to know their stories, I was wondering, well, if this is happening in the polygamy groups, I wonder if it's happening in the mainstream churches. Because in this particular case, polygamists believe in Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon. And so I wanted to go on a kind of a research, a journey to try to see if this was indeed an issue with other churches. And so I'm not here to bash the LDS church at all. But I do want to say that this is a pretty prevalent problem in our society, and it crosses all over all denominations, church denominations, fraternal organizations. It's been an infiltration. And so I want to tell everyone about what we're working on and how we can help survivors.
Wow, that is so amazing. How neat that you ended up, you know, like I said, finding this and then really latching on to it. When did you first hear of ritual abuse? When did that come into your vocabulary? Because I feel like still to this day, most people don't know about ritual abuse. It's still very foreign to a lot of society.
Well, I'm kind of embarrassed to say this, but when I was a kid growing up, and I grew up in a Christian church, I had Christian parents, but I loved to watch scary movies. And so we're talking Friday the 13th and Halloween. And I had an interest in knowing about spiritual things and what was beyond what we could see. So I remember my first book I read was Michelle Remembers. And that was a book that came out in the 70s or 80s. And I read through that and I'm like, that's when I learned what ritual abuse was. And so it was from there that I just started delving deeper into it. And I recognized it because I actually had some paraphenomenon happen in my own home. So I took up my sword and my armor of Christ, and I slayed those demons. And so I wanted to help other people do the same. So it was really kind of a culmination of my upbringing and my devotion to Christ, and recognizing that we have a very powerful dark enemy that wants to destroy us. Like the Bible says, they come to steal, kill, and destroy. And so if we are recognizing that is the purpose of the enemy, then we can do things to combat the enemy better. So when they were telling me the things that were going on, the phenomenons that were going on in their home as a result of this ritual abuse and all the physical attacks that they were coming across, that's when I knew it was ritual abuse. And that's when I went to go do some more research. And lo and behold, what I did is I read an article about Glenn Pace. So Glenn Pace was a general authority in the LDS Church. He was assigned a general authority from 1985, and he served until he died in 2017. And so there had been reports of ritual abuse happening in the church and among church membership. And so he was asked to investigate. And so he did that. He interviewed 60 survivors of ritual abuse. There were 53 females and 7 males who were interviewing. And he came to believe them. Every word they said, he was convinced that this has actually happened to him. So he reported this to the church leaders, and the church leaders decided to do a bigger investigation. So they asked the governor at the time, which was Norman Bangeter, to fund an investigation, which lasted 2.5 years. And so after 2.5 years, they dropped the case, and they cited that there was not enough evidence to prove what these survivors had gone through. And not one person was arrested or convicted. And that was the end of it. They just decided to shove it under the rug. And Glenn knew that this was not right. And I also recognized that, too. I was suspicious. I was like, wait a second. You listened to 60 individuals tell their stories. They had the same perpetrators, same locations. They went through the same rituals. And yet they couldn't find one person to convict of this sex trafficking crime. And so I went in and I delved into more stats to prove that something was going on here right under our very noses. So I want to pull up the my slides to share.
Okay. Yes, let's go through that.
Okay, so I'm going to advance, hopefully. Okay, this is kind of my intro to our organization. Like I said before, we're a nonprofit Christian organization. We've been doing this since 2018. We have a 501(c) status. We have board of directors, and we have 11 staff. So what we do is we offer survivors of ritual abuse with resources and support they need to heal. So we're in contact with counselors, lawyers, partnering agencies to get them what they need. Additional services, but we personally don't provide, like shelter and getting them legal aid. So we do work with lawyers to help them submit cases. And that's what we're currently doing. And we take the cases that none of the other agencies want to deal with because they're very complex. And anyway, yeah, we want to take on what other people have been too afraid to take on. So what is ritual abuse? It's a subcomponent of sex trafficking, which is also a form of human trafficking. And ritual abuse involves the physical, mental, sexual torture designed to induce compliance in child victims. And then hopefully what the perps want is for these child victims to turn into perpetrators themselves. And so I'm not going to belabor this because your audience is already full of survivors of sex trafficking, but we recognize it as multi-generational problem. It started way, way back in people's history, and it went through bloodlines. And they believe that spiritual power are in their bloodlines to give them the justification for doing this to children. And so, like I said, just in our research over the years, we found out that this is happening in Baptist church, Methodist church, Catholic churches, Freemasonry, and the LDS church as well. And so what we're finding out is that there are these ritual abuse members who infiltrate churches because we know not everybody's bad in all churches. So it's definitely deliberate that they would choose certain churches that are vulnerable for infiltration, and that they would go in there to try to profane the sacred, and they remain mostly undetected because people aren't expecting child sacrifice to be going on in a church. But unfortunately, that is the case. And so I'll talk about that later. I spoke about Glenn Pace, And then one of the first things, and are you able to see my screen up here, including the title?
Or is I see Utah statistics, something isn't right.
Yeah. So in my study, I wanted to prove that this was actually going on because I knew that was going to be the first thing. I had already gotten comments like, oh, if that was happening here, it'd be all over the news. We would hear about there'd be court cases. And I'm like, no, that isn't what's happening here. It's all done in secret, so you wouldn't know. And what I found is that in Utah, we had the 9th highest age-adjusted suicide rate in the U.S. for teens, 2020, and an overall 66% higher suicide rate than the rest of the country. So this is the crazy part. Utah is one of the smallest states in the nation. We only have 3 million people, and we're beating out the larger states in suicide rates. Texas, California, New York. I mean, this is astounding to me. So this is chart here is from the Utah Department of Health. And the red line that you see is the suicide rate for males in the U.S. in general. And then the blue line is the Utah suicide rate for males. So you can see we have quite a bit higher suicide rate among our men and boys. And then down below is the female suicide rate for the U.S. females in purple. And then the yellow is correspondingly the suicide rate for Utah females. So that's a little bit higher as well. So the next thing I wanted to look at was antidepressant drugs. And so antidepressant drugs are prescribed in Utah more often than in any other state at a rate nearly twice the national average. So again, tiny little 3 million person Utah is beating out all the other much more bigger states with antidepressant drugs. And that's telling me there's a lot of people that are struggling with mental health in Utah. And then the next metric I looked at was the online pornography issue we have here in Utah. Survivors told me over and over again that they were being filmed during the rituals. And so the biggest consumer of online pornography was Utah in a study conducted by Harvard in 2009. By 2016, the problem had become so big that our governor had to declare pornography a crisis in our state. Right. And so the next metric I want to address then is mental health. So I'm going to be going forward here. You see a map of the U.S. According to a report published by the University of Utah, Utah was the 51 when it came to mental health care access. So we have the highest need, but the fewest options. The red states are the ones that have the least amount of mental health care access and providers. The white states are the ones that are doing the best. But I found that Utah is the 16th most wealthiest state in the nation. And we have these two wonderful universities that churn out counselors and psychiatrists and other professionals, yet we can't help our own people within this state. It astounds me. The last thing I'll discuss then, So I just wanted to share a metric, which was according to the National Center for Victims of Crime, approximately 1 in 5 girls and 1 in 20 boys experienced sexual abuse before age 17. And I wanted to point out again, this Utah is not exempt from this. We're also having these kind of metrics. This is astounding. 1 in 5 girls are going to be sexually abused before they're adults. I find this is so sad. And we need to change this as a society. Enough is enough. Virtual abuse victimization. These are some of the common observations that we've made in when we see victims come in. They're used for both sex and labor. So it's not only just the rituals and the sexual aspect that's a part of this, but they will actually put these kids to work and to help make money. They don't get paid. It's just another form of human slavery. The abuse is excessive, which includes physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual torture. The drugs are usually used. The abuse is used to maintain control over the victim. A lot of people have told me they've been programmed to conduct different tasks. They're given a specific job. They'll talk about their beta kitten parts. Because as we know, most of the survivors, like 95% of my survivors, have DID or dissociative identity disorder. So they'll tell us what parts they have and what their jobs are. And then they will also tell us like what triggers them and causes them to go into that dissociative state. So there are a lot of commonalities among the perpetrators and how they do that, either using code words, symbols, hand gestures, and other simple signatures that they use to keep survivors compliant and performing as they are expected. And so victims are told if they tell anyone, they're going to be killed or their family members killed. And so that's why we don't hear about it. Kids don't normally speak up about this. They're terrified. And in addition to that, they, because of the drugs they're given and because they're dissociated, a lot of them don't remember what has happened to them till years later. The vast majority of our survivors start to get memories when they're in their 30s and 40s. And that's because a traumatized brain can't calm down enough to recall until their nervous system calms down. And this might take decades. Some survivors still don't feel safe. And so they struggle in remembering what happened to them, but they know something went wrong and they're getting flashbacks and nightmares. So that's when they usually come for us, to us for help. So what I want to say here is the aftermath of they experience nightmares, flashbacks, crippling, insomnia, DID, PTSD, depression, anxiety, shame, a host of other issues. The unfortunate part is that many of our survivors have been incorrectly diagnosed with bipolar, schizophrenia, or other diagnoses that isn't helping them solve the problem. They have physical problems. We've seen survivors come in with bowel issues, chronic defecation, sexual dysfunction, UTIs, STDs, scars, broken bones, and sometimes nothing at all, because some of these perpetrators are smart and they're very careful because they don't want to leave any evidence behind. So a lot of their injuries are then internal. Young females will have unintended pregnancies at the end, usually in an abortion ceremony. They have inability to function. Survivors can't keep a job. They can't finish school. And this results in poverty. A lot of my survivors are on government aid for the rest of their life. Relationships are challenging. 99% of my survivors have been divorced at least once. And they usually also have trouble maintaining friendships. They feel isolated as a result. And we also have noticed that there are, like I said, high rates of suicide, extensive drug and alcohol abuse. So this is typical within a ritual abuse. It's a summary of what ritual abuse all entails in the aftermath. So sodomy plays a big part in ritual abuse, and there's a few reasons why. So sodomy is anal or oral penetration with another person or object. And so children are sodomized because it plays a specific purpose. It has a key role. The sodomy steals the child's innocence and breaks them down. And they usually start, I don't know if I mentioned this before, our survivors usually start being abused by the time when they're babies, as soon as they're born, up until usually around, well, up to 18. Some of them escape and become adults and move away, get married. And so sometimes the abuse will start then. But we have survivors that are well into adulthood and they're still being accessed. So sodomy gives these people power because that's what Satan has told them to do. It's easier to then program that child or manipulate that child if they've been sodomized. But the most interesting part is that sodomy affects the brain. So I started looking at scientific journals. A study in 2017 was published in the Industrial Psychology Journal. The colon and rectum are innervated by two distinct pathways, the lumbar and the sacral nerves. And so the study found that childhood sex trauma is associated with negative changes in the brain structure, the volume of the brain, including the prefrontal cortex. So I'm going to show you a photo of a PET. This is a brain PET scan. You have to get a doctor's order to get one of these scans done. And then there's special places to get the PET scan. This one is called a brain activity PET scan. And so on the left-hand side, you're going to see a normal, healthy brain of a child. So we have highlighted prefrontal cortex. The temporal lobes are intact. Everything looks good here. But then on the right-hand side, you're going to see this is an eight-year-old child who was sexually abused and physically abused as a child. This eight-year-old child is going to have cognitive and emotional problems for the rest of his life. So this is good evidence we can use in a court case to prove that ritual abuse is going on because we can see the damage that it has caused. So the other things I wanted to point out, this is on the left is obviously a normal colon, but on the right is a child that's had sodomy. Over and over again, it destroys the physical structure of the colon. As you can see, it's got hills and valleys where there shouldn't be. It's stretched out. And you could see how it'd be difficult to pass, have a bowel movement and push feces through that system. So that causes a lot of distress for the kids. Often there'll be spontaneous defecation at school. They'll have accidents, which are embarrassing. And because they can't retain their feces, I'm trying not to be very graphic, but you can imagine if large objects are shoved in that area, it's going to cause damage. And so we've seen that. This is a 15-year-old client of mine. She's showing her scars from her abuse. Now, these photos are 2 years old, so they've had time to heal, but you can still see on the left-hand side here, she's been given an IV so often that she blew out her blood vessels. They essentially collapse. So this is after a prolonged period of time. It was much worse, she said, when she was being abused. And then the center is where she was burned with a cattle prod on her arm. So you can see the big, huge bruise down here and then smaller bruises. These are defense wounds that she received trying to fight off that cattle prod. And then over here on the right-hand side, she said one of the perpetrators put his cigarette out on her wrist. And so this is a burn mark. This is pretty common what we see here. I do want to give a trigger warning, and I should have did this long before I got into this, but if this is triggering anyone, please feel free to drop off and watch this later if you want to. You can also contact our organization and we will discuss your story with you and find out what happened because we believe the survivors. I think that's what makes us different than police or DCFS or anybody else is we believe the survivors the first time. We don't deny them and we encourage them and validate them. And no, you're not crazy. You're not alone. There's other people who've been through this. And if we all get together and we fight this fight together, things can happen. Things can change. And we've started to see change in Utah. So ritual abuse outcomes, vast majority of perpetrators are not caught. That is the problem we're having here in Utah. There is definitely a concerted effort to protect perpetrators here in Utah. And so you can imagine because of political, people in power pretty much want to keep this covered up because a lot of them are involved in the ritual abuse. So I'll just say it like that. Most perpetrators, when they are caught, rarely are prosecuted or they have light sentences. Tom Green was a polygamist here. He raped his daughters, got one pregnant, married her, raped her again. And so it was pretty much obvious what he had done to her. So he did get prosecuted, but only spent 6 years in jail. Can anyone tell me, has a pedophile ever been restored within 6 years in a prison? No, it's impossible. They can't be rehabilitated. Pedophiles will abuse 170 children during their lifetime. And like I said, they can't be rehabilitated. 37% of the victims become perpetrators themselves. And so my point here is we want longer jail sentences for these people. We want to keep them off the street for as long as we possibly can. And 6 years isn't enough. 25 years isn't even enough. But that's as best as we're going to get from any legislator in this country. So we'll take 25 years. That's better than the 6 years they have now. I think actually the least amount of time spent in jail was 5 years. So we have to stop that. And I'll be sharing with you some legislation reforms that everybody can do across the country. It doesn't have to be just in Utah. So we understand victims aren't lying. They have the same experiences. 93% of psychologists said the survivors are telling the truth. False memories were never ratified by the American Psychological Association. That means the satanic panic has been debunked. It's not real. False memories is not real. What you remember as an abuse survivor, that is truth. And we embrace that. We want you to embrace that too. And so this has been going on for a long time. My oldest client is 82 years old. The abuse starts at birth, goes until adulthood, sometimes beyond that. But 85% of my survivors, they were abused by their parents. Their parents knew what was going on. They did nothing about it and or participated in it. And so you can imagine how those relationships are broken up between themselves, their siblings, based on what goes on in these rituals. And what we're finding out, at least in Utah, the kids are groomed at church during Sunday school. They're abused at their schools, private homes, and they're taken to businesses. In Utah, we're mostly white here. So our perps are usually white, clean-cut men in elite positions. So we're talking police, politicians, judges, lawyers, doctors. There isn't one profession that isn't untouched by ritual abuse. They all serve their purposes during the rituals. The police keep watch, make sure nobody comes around to see what's going on. And so since the police are involved, and a lot of them are, and we know some of them here, we don't know who we can trust. Survivors don't know who they can trust. They can't go to their attorney general's office because the attorney general is involved in this. They can't go to police stations because they're not sure who in there is involved in this. And so we've witnessed so many cases of abuse and sex trafficking here that have been dropped by law enforcement and the different law offices in this state. This is why we formed Relentless Hope. Because we've said enough is enough. We're just normal citizens. We're all volunteering for this. None of us get paid. But we want to stop the perpetration upon children. So why survivors don't speak? I get this all the time when I go in and speak to people. Why don't they speak up then? You know, if we knew about this, we would do something about it. And I challenge them on that too, because a lot of people that I talk to about this topic don't want to hear about it. They want to turn a blind eye to this. They can't handle it because they're like, oh, that's too much. You can't talk to me about this. So this is really challenging for us to even convince leaders to take this on. But what I go through here is survivors have been threatened by perps. That's why they don't speak. Their own family members and friends. They've been threatened by law enforcement to keep quiet and their own church leaders. The media has a blackout on this topic. We have tried to get this on national news, local news. They won't touch it. And the reason is because the media outlets are owned by the perpetrators. So we have evidence of that through our research. In addition, like I said, police are involved, politicians are involved. So, and then on top of that, the public doesn't want to hear about it. So that's another reason why we formed this organization. We want to hear about it. We want survivors to call us. We would love to talk to you about what you've gone through and walk through a healing journey with you. So you can go to our website. It's relentlesshopeforyou.org. It's all spelled out for you.org. So I'll also have that at the end of my presentation. In addition, survivors don't speak out because it's too hard for them to repeat their story time and time again. We try to get the story once and not have them repeat it unless they feel like they want to be, they want to go through that process, because the more you talk about it, the more you release it. And so that is a healthy way to deal with abuse, is to talk it out and get it out there. Telling their story, though, can cause re-triggering and dissociation. So we're really careful. They're also afraid they won't be believed, and they've had victim blame and shame. And then the last is the lack of evidence, but we're changing that with those scans. And I'm going to talk to you about legislation reforms everybody can do in each one of their states to help protect children, prevent this kind of abuse, and take down as many perpetrators as possible. So what we have proposed to Utah legislators are the following: to eliminate the priest penitent privilege law. This is an exemption that protects clergy or your pastor or your bishop or whoever in your church. They don't, if a perpetrator in the church comes and confesses to them, they don't have to say a thing. They don't have to report. They don't have to even be forced to testify against a perpetrator because they're a member of their own church. We find this very disturbing. We don't like this at all. And there have been many cases dropped because of this law. The next thing we want to do is remove all statutes of limitations on child sex crimes. We're going to be working on that right now in Utah. A survivor only has 4 years to come forth and sue their perpetrator or file criminal charges against them. I don't know a single survivor that can go through that abuse, remember all of it, heal from it, and then they're going to be strong and healthy and be able to stand in front of a court of law. That's impossible in 4 years. So we are asking for longer statutes of limitations. Mandatory reporting rules should also be extended to adults if the crime was never reported in the first place. And so we're recommending a database be built so that survivors can self-report themselves through this database that would then be open to public scrutiny. Of course, survivors would be private. Their names wouldn't be out there. That all would be protected. But at least with a database, we would be able to find out exactly where the survivors are being taken and abused, who is doing that abuse, and a bunch of other demographics that we would love to know so we can start going after these perpetrators. I guarantee you, if there's a database where survivors can go, they're going to name multiple perpetrators that other survivors have dealt with. And when you put that information together, we'd be able to say, ha ha, we know this church leader in this particular church has hurt at least 15 kids. So we need to do something about him and take him off the street. The other thing is we need full scope exams for survivors, because this is important evidence for a court of law. If you want to take your perpetrator to court, or if you want to file criminal acts against him, criminal charges is what I'm trying to say, then this provides awesome, awesome evidence. But currently, doctors are the only ones that can say if these reports are accessible. You can't go in and request this unless there's two conditions met. The doctor has to see blood coming out of the child's orifices, and then the child themselves have to report what happened to them. So there's two problems with that. One, the children are not going to say anything because they've been threatened that they'll be killed if they say anything. So they're not going to say anything, especially the little ones. And then secondly, we know that survivors have internal wounds in those areas that don't produce bleeding. So in that case, the doctors won't order the exams to see where all the damage and injuries are taking place. And there again, we don't have evidence. So we're trying to change legislation to force doctors to give survivors those exams free of charge at their request. Churches should have child safety protocols in place. Here in Utah, the churches don't have background checks for people who work with children. They also don't have common sense precautions, like not allowing a child to go behind closed doors with an adult that's not their parent. To me, this is just common sense. But unfortunately, we have to legislate this as well. Prison terms, like I discussed earlier, is child offenders need 25 years minimum. And if they're repeat, and this one makes some people laugh, but if they're repeat offenders, we're pushing for castration. I don't know how you all feel about that, but there's nothing like chemical or surgical castration that will cut down those desires in those perpetrators. And so we're going to push that and see how far we get. The next issue is police should be required to take a report from a victim claiming ritual abuse. So many survivors have tried to go into police offices or district precincts and file a report, but they're turned down because the police officers don't believe them. They think they're crazy. They gaslight them. They do everything they can do to dissuade them. And so if a survivor doesn't have a police report, they can't get reparations. And so reparations need to be paid to help survivors to be able to get the medical care they need, to get the counseling they need, and whatever services they need to heal. And so we need to force the law enforcement to take reports so we can start collecting them so survivors can get the money they need to get some help. And then last, we want to provide education and training to schools, churches. We want to teach teachers. We want to show them these are the signs of sexual abuse. These are signs of ritual abuse. You need to know both so you can identify it in your students. And likewise, we want to train police officers so they too can recognize this when they are called to a house where there may be a child that is being abused. And so those are some of the legislative reforms we're going to push. And as you see here, this is my personal email address. If you want to contact me at info@relentlesshopeforyou.org. You can also find us on beginhoping.org, and this will take you to our website address. And there you can hit the need help button on the homepage. You can fill out a form. It's private. It's confidential. It's encrypted. Nobody can intersect to get it. Our staff, it comes directly to us, and we review it, and we call you. And that's where you can start your healing journey. And if you do want to go after your perpetrator, we can assist you with legal help in that regards. Some survivors don't want to get involved in cases. I get it. They want to heal and move on with their life. But for those who need closure, we have lawyers that can help you. So, and it doesn't matter what state you're from. So let us know. And that's it. That's all I got for you right now. But yeah, that's what we do every day, all day long.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing. There was so much to unpack with this.
Yeah.
First of all, thank you for putting that together. I love when guests provide visuals just because some people are visual learners, and I love like the organization of it and the flow. So thank you for putting that together. That's really helpful, you know, to disperse information. And I encourage everybody to go back and take screenshots of those.
Absolutely.
Screen record that part where she was just going over that presentation and send it to people. Make little clips of that. That was like such a good you know, part of the video to go make clips and go post on TikTok or Facebook or
absolutely
wherever you guys want to do that. I wanted to back up. I want to dig into some of the things that you said. So you were working with other nonprofits before you started yours. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the difference? So I want people to understand, because I think a lot of people do that, even nonprofits that say that they're helping are still limiting themselves. Can you explain, when you knew about ritual abuse and you're working with other organizations, how was that perceived? How was action taken? And like, what was the difference between what you're doing, which is literally going right for the neck of this, versus what you experienced in working for other nonprofits?
Yeah. So I have the same issues that survivors have, and that I would tell people what was going on and they wouldn't believe me. And it was very discouraging, but I just kept pushing. I'm like, by golly, we're going to get this out and people are going to listen. And so my experience in the previous organization gave me face-to-face, like I said, experience with survivors of ritual abuse. And I learned so much. I learned how to run an agency business-wise. I have an MBA, so that came naturally, but the previous organization pretty much showed me how to start an agency, how to run it, how to do the marketing and advertising, how to do the accounting. Nonprofits are, you know, tax deductible donations. That's a whole new ball of wax to get together with an accountant, being able to keep track of your records. I mean, it's overwhelming. There's management roles, there are operation roles, there's insurance you got to consider that people just don't take into it. And all that costs money. So then you need money. So then you got to do fundraisers. And I mean, it's on and on and on. And you got to know the people. I lived here for 20 years. So I already had people I knew I could call and trust that would help out with this. So I'm impressed with people. Members of the LDS Church are very concerned about this. They're like, Cindy, we want to know the truth so we can do something about it. So tell us the truth. And, you know, they are like, that's more important because kids are important. But that took a while to turn the public around on that. And it's because I go on podcasts and I tell people straight up what's going on. I don't hold any punches and I do the surveillance and I'm like, oh, okay, here's the pictures. This is evidence. You want to see the video? Let's look at that. Okay. And so I'm not shy or bashful at all about calling perpetrators out and going after them. So I'm looking forward to building cases to get the truth out there as much as possible. So, yeah, I take actually great pleasure in upsetting the perpetrators who do this. So.
Oh, I love it. And I love you. Yes. You just have this, like, you're so cute and you look like just this, you know, sort of delicate woman. You're just beautiful. And then you just have this freaking warrior ass spirit in you. I'm like,
oh my gosh, I own guns. I don't go out there alone. I take my gun. Are you crazy? Yeah. Yes. Because some of this is work. I'm trespassing to get evidence.
Talk about this. Let's go into this part because I want people to hear this. This absolutely blew my mind and my jaw is still on the floor learning about how you're getting evidence. So share with us what you're doing.
So once I started interviewing survivors that have been through this, I asked them, where did this happen? Let's go. And so some of them are like, okay. So we would go and they would take me to the ritual abuse places. And we would take plastic bags and gloves and swabs for DNA evidence. And we would sneak into buildings or sneak onto property, grab what evidence we could find. And then we took it to law enforcement or we took it to an anthropologist. We found bones we thought may have been the bones of a victim. So it was wrapped up in a tarp. And so we took it to the anthropologist. She said, no, these are not human, but they are owl bones. And so, well, lo and behold, we know that owls, unfortunately, I really like owls, but they are used as a satanic symbol for witchcraft. And so they're often sacrificed during rituals. So, but nonetheless, it's still evidence. We had blood evidence, those bones. We have done swabs in buildings where we know survivors were ritually abused. We've taken DNA samples and tons of photos of the inside of these buildings where this has happened. I've crawled down into a tunnel that went under the building. This one particular survivor was telling me that after the ceremony was over, there would usually be body parts. And so the adults would force the kids to put these body parts in a bag and crawl in a tunnel under the building for like 30 yards and dump them underground somewhere. I know the site. And so we took video and photo of those tunnels because when the survivor went to the city council, she was brave. She says, there are tunnels under this building where I was forced to drag body parts through. And they're like, there's no tunnels. And she pulled up those photos and she's like, well, what's this? We had photos down in those tunnels because we had snuck in the back door. And we went down there and we took a ton of photos. And we also photoed the inside of the building so they knew we weren't making this up. We're like, see, here's the gym. Oh, here is the governor's office. Oh, by the way. Yeah. So anyway, we had tons of photos. And she said the councilmen were in shock. Anyway, sometimes people won't believe until they see hard evidence. And so that's what we do. And that's what we're going to do this upcoming week. And I can't share with you where we're going, but we do it undercover. And my lawyer probably doesn't want me to say any of this, but I'm sharing it with your audience.
Oh my gosh. It's making my heart beat fast just thinking about doing that. Like how... Can you talk about what, like your process, like how do you stay calm and like what's going through your mind whenever you're doing these missions where you're going out? Like, is that really scary for you?
No, because I have Jesus on my side. God is on my side, right? I know he's going to protect me. We don't do anything stupid. We have policies to keep each other safe. We never go alone. I always carry my gun. We plan in advance. We find out what schedules are so we know when people won't be there. And then we don't leave a track of evidence. We use gloves. We wear black. I mean, you know, it's kind of fun, actually.
So, like James Bond.
Yeah. It's
like Harry the Spy.
Well, yeah, we don't want to be identified, right? Well, right. I don't. Anyway, obviously people know what I'm doing, but
you're so fearless.
I have good lawyers. Let's put it that way.
How has this been received when you take this evidence into the police or law enforcement, even lawyers, like what is happening as you and these survivors are pushing, you know, trying to push this into the legislation, into the courts, into getting police reports, like what's happening as you're doing this?
We're collecting all the survivor statements who want to come forward. We do background searches where that survivor was abused at. We research those locations really well. We pull plat plans from the city to find out how these buildings are structured and their underground structures. We look into the perpetrator's past. Once we identify a perpetrator, we look their grandparents, great grandparents, and try to find pieces to put the puzzle together. Because so many of these ritual abuse groups, they tie into each other, they form networks, right? So if this person hears grandma is another person's grandma over here, then we can start to make those connections and we find out what the families are. and who's all involved in those families. Because like I said, 37% of survivors become perpetrators themselves. So if grandma and grandpa did it, mom and dad did it, guess what? Son and daughter, half of them are probably getting into it as well. And so we keep an eye on them. I know I'm telling a lot of secrets and my lawyer's probably going to tell me to shut up after this. But anyway, I want people to know they can do the same exact thing. I'm nobody special. You just got to have the a little bit of guts and a little help from your friends and just, yeah, tenacity. Yeah, I would say that I'm tenacious.
You're very tenacious and brave.
Then you got to have a big mouth to go tell it to legislators and police and lawyers. So that's the winning combination.
And so how are police, lawyers, law enforcement, what's their response when you are sharing this evidence or when a survivor goes into to try to get a police report? Are you running into a lot of red tape where you're still seeing this being turned away, or are you slowly making a dent? Like, what has happened over these few years that you've been pushing this?
So a lot in the past, cases have been dropped by law enforcement, by attorney generals, by even higher ranking. I worked with the Department of Homeland Security on 20 cases, 20 cases. They only interviewed 7 of the 20, and then they dropped all of them, citing statutes of limitations. And I'm like, there's no statute of limitation on murder. And every one of my survivors had witnessed murder of children. So I said, that's bogus. I don't, you know, that. And they're like, what do we do? You know, and that was it. And we're finding similar problems in other areas in Utah. So, and I hear that's not uncommon. When we go to law enforocement, there are some good law officers out there. I support our men and women in blue, but there's some who aren't. So it just depends on the precinct that you're working within. There are certain precincts that all the survivors around here know are not good. And so you got to find another route to report your case. So what survivors can do is just completely bypass the police altogether, and you can take your case to the prosecuting attorney in that county or a state prosecutor. So there are options. You can take it straight to the attorney general if you trust them. So there are other options that you can get around the police. And you can also just go straight to a lawyer and show them all your evidence. And we often refer our clients to pro bono lawyers through various organizations that are here and nationwide as well. So that's how we can help survivors who are in Massachusetts or Texas or New York or wherever, because we get survivors from all over the nation coming to us. Just because we're in Utah doesn't mean we can't help people outside of our state.
Wow. And oh my gosh, you have got to be so busy. This has to be just a crazy journey for you. Oh my goodness.
It is, but my son has grown up, so I don't have anything else to do, right?
Oh my gosh, your passion. I just love it. It is so inspiring to me. Like, I just feel this fire with you, and it's like energizing me right now. I feel your passion. I can hear it. And it excites me because this is not common to hear of anybody out there, especially sort of playing on the 501c3 lines. Like, that's usually a very delicate place where it is like a no zone to talk about something like ritual abuse or satanic ritual abuse, these networks. Can you talk a little bit about the red tape that you've run into as far as resistance? How has the public around you been? I know you said the LDS Church has started to embrace you. What are you finding is happening when you're out in the communities talking? Are you generally finding this is being received? Are you getting threats? Are you being supported? Are you being turned away? Like, what's the response as you're just bulldozing your way through with this information? Because this has to be kind of shocking for people to just see you just out there, like, so fearless when so much, you know, that state, it's like, so many people I think know how corrupt it is, but it's very quiet. Like, there's not a lot of people like going right for it, you know, and here you come in, you're like, well, I'm going to do it. Like,
yeah. Well, you know, I just surround myself with smart people that help me, good friends, and a good support system. That's really what it's all about. Since I've lived here for 20 years, I know a lot of people, and I've just like, this is going on. You need to do this. This is going on. Come to this event. I want you to learn about this. And I just ask my friends, can you volunteer just 2 hours a week to help a survivor? Oh my gosh. Because most of the survivors who call in, they just want somebody to listen to them and validate them and say, yes, we believe you. This did happen. And so it doesn't take any required education. It's a loving heart, a ready ear to listen, and compassion. That's all it takes. We have a training program. So everybody that comes and volunteers for us are trained. And so we don't just stick them out there on their own and just say, all right, start talking to the survivors, because you, if you're not trained, you can actually do more harm if you're not using the best words. There's definitely words that you don't want to say around a survivor. There are certain activities you don't want to do around a survivor. And so they have to be made aware. But we also need investigators. I have a volunteer investigative team that we give them cases. And we're like, you're going to work this case for us. Just stay at home on your computer. We're going to give you the tools and you can start researching about this particular perpetrator. And that's going to help us solve crimes and cases. So we need that. We need advocates, but advocates are very special. That we're a little more picky about, but the researchers, the more the merrier, because we've got a lot of cases. So between me and my partner, we have interviewed over 200 survivors, and that's every day we're growing. So and we've created partnerships too throughout the country. So a lot of survivors may know about floodlit.org. It was put together by a former survivor. He built it. And this is really pertaining to LDS members. So LDS members who've been abused can go to that website and they can identify their perpetrator and where they were perpetrated on. And so it's kind of a database that they're building. So that can also be used as evidence in a case. So there are people that are more open to hear about this now. We're trying to educate as many people as possible and let them know that this is prevalent in their communities. I don't care if it's a rural community or a large metro city. It's happening. And we just keep making contacts. I keep meeting legislators. Going to the Capitol to testify for bills. Just networking. And so that's really, at least that's how we're doing it. It seems to be effective, and I would encourage anybody else to do similar thing. I'd be happy to speak to them about that.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Have you been, whether it's, I guess online or even in person, have you gotten threats or have there been any retaliations or anything like that against you since you started?
Not yet, which tells me I'm not threatening enough yet. And also because I'm very vocal that I carry a big gun and I have two strong men at my house that will take them down if they give me any problems. So I know law enforcement, I know bikers, I know people that are watching out for me and protecting me. But no, I haven't gotten any threats as of yet. I've been doing this for 6 years.
Amazing. So. Wow. Because I was going to say, I love that you're out speaking about this publicly, because I think that's a mistake that some people make, whether they're, you know, want to talk about this or something else that's controversial or dangerous to talk about. Yeah. Is they internalize it and then they, versus it being something that they're sharing with the public that they're doing, they keep it very private. And so there's not eyes on them. So if something happens, people think it's an accident and they don't know what the person is working on, where you're very transparent and you're like, hey, I have a 501c3, like I'm official. This is what we're working on. I'm going to go on podcasts. I'm going to talk about this. I'm going to get out in the community. I mean, they'd be crazy to threaten you, you know, any, because people are going to be questioning it. Like, wait a minute. Like, that's something's wrong here. And I think they probably know that too, you know? So you probably are a bigger threat than you know. I bet they're shaking in their boots that you're out there. I would be terrified of you. And instead, I'm so inspired.
Well, I'm, again, very vocal. I was running a Substack, and at the end of every article I wrote, I said, I'm healthy. I would never commit suicide. I don't have any health issues. I'm like, if I die, something bad has happened. It wasn't an accident. And I would end every article like that, because you're exactly right. If you make a bigger splash, people are going to stay further away from you, because they know if something happens to you, everybody else is going to suspect, okay, something happened here. This wasn't suicide. This wasn't an accident. So yeah, I got that. So I keep doing it till somebody threatens me, and then I'll get my lawyers on them. So
there you go, girl. What does your family and friends think of this? And what sort of, cause I mean, ritual abuse, satanic ritual abuse, again, like it's a hard topic. Like, how in your own personal life has this affected you? Has this been a positive experience? Have you had people turn away from you? Like, what has it been like personally going through all of this?
Oh yeah. I've had people betray me, talk bad about me, try to discredit me. Oh, the full gamut. Absolutely. Absolutely. I just roll with the punches, and we just, it motivates us to just work harder to get people the information they need to make their own decisions. And to prove to a court of law and the state legislator that they need to pass rules to protect children. And so that's, yeah.
What guidance would you give to survivors who are maybe considering going to court? A lot of them want to, but they're afraid of the same things that you outlined earlier, that they're not going to be believed, that they don't have evidence. Like, do you have any advice? I know it's probably different for every person, but maybe just things that you've seen personally in your experience work for a survivor. Maybe we could talk about that. Like, what has worked, and what are some things that you've seen survivors do that have helped them help themselves at being their own advocates?
Absolutely. I encourage every survivor to talk, to speak out, to get on podcasts, to write articles, to write letters to their legislators, to be as loud as you could possibly be. I know there's the fear there. I get that. I totally get that. But you can do it. You just got to get your own little support group around you. And I know that's hard if your family was involved, but you join support groups. That's a good start. So here at Relentless Hope, we hold support groups twice a month, and anybody that's a survivor can join in on it. And so survivors support each other. They're like, oh my gosh, that happened to you. That happened to me. Let's talk about this. And we just have discussions, and nothing is off the table. They get encouragement through that, and they get empowered when there's more numbers to get behind them. So joining a support group is really good. Getting counseling. If you do go to a court trial, it's going to be brutal. And so you need a counselor that's going to have your back. Be there when you have the down up days and the down days. You're going to need that emotional support to get through it. But okay, I'm going to go on a rabbit trail. So a lot of survivors do not need to go to court and be in front of their perpetrators. You can actually settle a case outside of the court working through lawyers. So you don't ever have to see that creep again. You don't ever have to see who hurt you. Again, what the lawyers do is they go and they make a demand letter to the perpetrator or the organization who trafficked them. And they can say, we want $500,000. And if you don't give that to us, we got all this evidence and we're going to expose you. So, I mean, that's how it works. And so you have to be careful what lawyer you get. You got to get one that is trustworthy, because so many lawyers are involved in this. So you first got to identify a good, safe lawyer who has tenacity and wants to take this down. they have to be just as passionate, which is hard too. We've ever had a really hard time trying to get lawyers, but they're out there. They're out there. They have to be lawyers who are licensed in your state. So you can't take a case in your state, in your jurisdiction, with a lawyer that's outside of your state. That person has to be licensed within your state. There's a lot of law firms out there that will take on these cases. They will come, they will produce a class action lawsuit. And so they're trying to get a lot of survivors in on this lawsuit so they have more power and more strength when they do go to these organizations and ask for money. So that is what we recommend to survivors. But there's always plan B. Like if they don't budge, okay, well, we'll get the media. Do you want us to expose you? Okay, we will. So it's like, don't take crap from perpetrators. Don't take crap from anyone. I'm so tired of these perpetrators having more power. And I know that they have put people through absolute hell. I know they've murdered people. I know they've proven to, you know, make their threats come to life. I get that. I so get that. But when you have a group of people with you and you're supporting one another and you've got a good lawyer and you have a safe place to live, which is important, you can do this. So one of the first things we do when a survivor comes to get help at our agency is we look at their living conditions. Are you in a safe place? Are you currently being trafficked? Is your handler still contacting you? And then based on that and whatever needs they have, we try to put them in long-term facilities that are Christian-based, private, 501c3s. That's important, all right? Because there are a lot of government-ran organizations that do not provide the safe help that they need. So we do usually send them to a private organization, 501c3 first. And then we highly recommend survivors getting as much counseling as possible. Like I said, a lot of them can't afford it. We're working on that avenue, but we also will help survivors get government aid so they can get Medicaid, which will pay for their counseling. So there's just a lot of different avenues. And so we take that all in consideration with our clients and then provide them encouragement, like I said, along the way. If they do need to get on disability, we help them with that. So there are a lot of different options. And yeah, we're doing the best we can. We're so busy right now. We need more help. We need more volunteers. So
what have you found with vetting lawyers and different people that you're bringing in your circle? And what advice do you have for survivors who are looking for these professionals? How can they maybe vet people that they essentially need in order to bring their case forward?
Yeah. So we have a vetting process. Anybody that wants to volunteer with us, we have like an online form they have to fill out. And we're looking for key words that they're going to use. We're asking certain questions that will tell us if this person is safe or not. So we're very specific. If a guy, and I hate to do this, but sorry, guys, most of the guys who do this, the perpetrating, they're guys. And so we're not going to put into any one of our positions a creepy 50-year-old guy to talk to a female. That is just not going to happen in our organizations. We have male advocates. We have female advocates for the females. So we take extra precaution there. We have a list of counselors that we recommend. And so those counselors that we work with, we know they're safe. We vet them as well. And just when you talk to people, you can tell if you're somewhat trustworthy. You look in their eyes, you look at their body language, and you can determine that person just saying things that just don't feel right. So, and then we do background checks on them. We see what they've been up to in the past, make sure they don't have any felonies on record, you know. So there's just, it's a multi-step process. We're very, very careful. Yeah, by the grace of God, we've got really great staff. So.
And you're growing. What are, like, what's next for you guys? And what's your vision? What do you see long term for Relentless Hope? And what are you, what's sort of in the future plans for you?
Well, I have to be somewhat cautious because I don't want the bad guys to know what we're up to, but we're definitely pushing legislation reform. We are in contact with legislators to get these certain laws passed. That's going to be one of our primary concerns going forward, trying to find, we're inundated with people that need safe places to live. And so we're trying to identify shelters throughout the country that can provide housing for the survivors. So we're working on that. We're working on trying to get the right lawyers in place for casework. We're making friends with people we know we can trust, certain law enforcement, certain lawyers. Again, we vet them. We ask about their reputations. We ask survivors, hey, we're considering this guy. Have you ever heard him being involved in one of these rituals or any? And I tell you, our survivors are so smart and they're so well connected. They're like, oh yeah, don't use him. I've had so many survivors tell me, don't use that lawyer. Don't trust that judge. Don't trust that politician. No. So we just work together as a team is essentially what we do. And we watch each other's back and we just, yeah.
We call it
like it is.
I love all the work and intention that you put into this, you know, and it like almost brings me to tears just hearing this from you. I'm like, oh my gosh, I know everybody that's going to listen to this is just going to feel that same like spark in their heart of like, oh my gosh, somebody gets it and they care. And like, they're out there advocating and like, they're doing what no other 501c3 is. Like you're teetering on that line that so many people are afraid to even get close to. And you're like, I'm not only going to teeter on it, I'm going to jump over it. I'm going to break it down and I'm going to throw rocks at it and like close it. And I love it. Like, I am just so excited for all of this. And like, I couldn't think of a better person to do this than you. I just listening.
Oh, thank you. That warms my heart. Thank you.
God picked you out for this. I know it. And I know
he
that.
He did.
Yes.
He did. He told me. He's like, you need to start an organization. I was really.
Yeah. Talk about what was that moment? How did you decide that you're going to do this?
I was in church because I had asked the Lord, should I be doing this? Should I start this agency? Because I was really scared. I'm like, it's going to take so much time. Do I have what it takes? Do we have enough people to start this? Where am I going to get money? You know, all these things were going through my head. And I had so much encouragement from friends and family members saying, you should do it. You should do it. And I was just at church and it was during worship. And I was just like, God, do you want me to do? I need to make a decision. And I just felt the Holy Spirit say, do it. And I said, yes, God, send me, which is a Bible verse. And so that's how it began. And we all work from our home. We don't have a building. We get on the phone with our survivors. We meet them in person or we get on Zoom. And so we have low cost because we don't have overhead, a building to take care of, maintenance, and all that kind of stuff. And we use free apps for our office. We don't go out and buy Word and PowerPoint. We use Google apps, all of them. And we use online, all of our records are stored online in Dropbox and other safe places. We do store a lot of the evidence and information on separate external drives because we are aware that these perpetrators can break in and hack services and into our computers. So we always keep the most important stuff on a separate server that is not accessed by the internet. That's important. So, yeah.
And what do you do to keep yourself healthy through this? I mean, listening to all of this, it's heavy. You know, this is really deep, dark stuff. How do you take care of yourself, and what's worked for you on the mental health side as you're traversing through all of this?
Okay, so I'll admit at the very beginning of this, I had almost a nervous breakdown because I was hearing it and I was feeling it. I mean, when they were describing what happened to them, I was like there with them mentally and emotionally. And I would replay this in my mind too. And I would imagine what I would do, how I would feel if I went through this, what was going on. And I got into a really deep, dark depression, and I had to pull back for a few months, and I had to get a counselor. But then I just kept praying to God, and I'm just like, God, I know this is where you want me to be, but you got to strengthen me and hold me up, because this is a big deal. This is dark. This is demonic and sadistic. And so he did. He pulled me back through it. I got back into the game. And I just, what I do, self-care is so important. I will step away if I'm feeling particularly down, take a few days off. But I do self-care. I'm really staunch on keeping my office hours. I work basically from 10 to 6, 10 to 5, Monday through Friday. I do not work on weekends. Do not, unless there's an emergency call. But yeah, I just keep my boundaries up, and I have good friends. I go out, I have fun. Because I'm running this organization. If I fail, then nobody's going to benefit from anything. So I got to keep myself healthy. So that's a priority for me.
I love that. Cause I think that that's another thing that, people get fearful of when they haven't gone through it is taking on that secondary PTSD. And so it's sort of easier to like tiptoe around it and like not fully look at it, maybe glance, or just look away because it's hard. But I think like, seeing people like me and you, like we are just like normal people, that are shouldering really hard things whenever we're listening to these testimonies. And I mean, you out there going to ritual sites and like all this really dangerous stuff, and I think that's what can give people hope too, is knowing that there's other people out there doing it, that like, we're not alone. There's an army out there. Like God has an army that's assembling right now, and it's way bigger than Satan's army, and that should take that fear out of us. We should just be fearing God and not fearing all these other things. It's that spirit of fear that keeps us stuck in our tracks, and I think you're such a great role model, stepping on the forefront, stepping on the battlefield, being one of the first, and, I certainly not the last. I was going to ask you too, as far as ritual abuse goes, if you were to have the attention of the whole world in a moment, what would you want them to know about ritual abuse, or what would be your message after doing this work for so many years?
I would say, we know it's real. We have survivors' testimony. We have evidence now that's available that proves that this is existing, and that people need to get on board quickly. Because if we don't do something about this, society will break down. We're going to be in huge trouble. This is a human rights crisis we're dealing with. And so it's time to wake up and get on board, because we're going somewhere and we need all the help we can get. So that's what I would say. Everybody has a part to play in this.
Yes, sister. And you, like I said, are the one that asked that question, what can I do about it? And you found an answer. And I want you to, again, I'm going to bring your website up. I love what you're doing. I want you to share again with people. You went over in your presentation, you covered a little bit of how people can help. I encourage people to help. I get asked all the time, what can I do? And I love that you're embracing an entire nation or in world. You're not just sticking with, oh, well, you only have to live here. You have to be on site. Like, you're offering, anybody essentially to get involved, whether they're a survivor or advocate. And I'd love for you to talk about opportunities that exist for people, how they can get in touch with you, what you're looking for in your helpers, and about your website and the resources that you have available.
Okay. Yeah. So the first way to contact me personally would be go into the contact at the top. Yeah, top right. You fill out that form. It's going to come directly to me. And that's where most people get a hold of me. I look at what they want. I consider what they're asking for, or I'll say, yeah, we have this opportunity here, or there, or whatever. And then we usually get on the phone, phone conversation, and that kickstarts that. Now, we are picky about our volunteers and that we need healthy people to volunteer, mentally healthy people to volunteer for survivors, to help them and make sure that they're taken care of first. And so we, like I said, we do background checks to make sure they don't have any criminal records. We're going to look into them. We're going to run them through questionnaires that help identify who would be a good match. And so the researchers, though, we have survivors helping out with research themselves. Some of them are like, hey, I like to look up stuff. I'd like to provide some information. Give me the tools and I'll identify a perpetrator and I'll run that through our system. And so we've got a lot of information through volunteer researchers. Again, you don't have to have any experience or education. We'll train you. So I would love to have more researchers. When we had fundraisers, we need people to help us set it up, run the booth, you know, do sound, marketing, advertising, everything. There's a little bit of something for everyone. So again, they can use our contact form to get this started. As far as resources, we do list some free resources for survivors. We have recommended books and articles. We have the Glenn Pace memo that got this all started. Free stuff for survivors. That's more local, but I do have a couple of things that are nationwide there. We have some helpful organizations, again, local and national. And then we do have a blog. And then for survivors only, underneath that, we want people to know they're not alone. So that's what our message is about. We do have an article that discusses signs and symptoms of ritual abuse, because a lot of survivors don't know if they were ritual abused. They know something's wrong, but they're like, well, I'm having flashbacks of the scary stuff that's happening, but I don't know. And so those are just some helpful signs for people that are interested, even for family members. Then we have a couple of survivor stories, and this is where the validation comes in. We have stories of what has happened to survivors in general. It doesn't get really detailed in the gory stuff, but it's enough information that people, after these they read these survivor stories, to know, hey, I'm not alone. This is happening. And two, it helps family members understand what they've been through. And so that is helpful to read it, but there is a trigger statement on it, because we try to be as accurate as possible while still trying to protect the identity of the survivor who has volunteered their story. And then the Get Help goes to our intake form, where, again, we have an encrypted form that people fill out online so people can't get access to their information. And that helps us know a little bit more about that survivor and what they're struggling with. And then we have a list of local shelters. This is specific only to Utah. But as we expand our network, we're hoping to be able to have more options for housing in the future. So that is pretty much it in a nutshell. And we're just happy to
start. I want
to
add one more thing. There is a donate button. Please go right to the source when you guys are considering where you give your money. You know, we do a lot of paying attention. And by paying, I mean with our energy, with our money, to other nonprofits that say that they're going to help and they don't. We give money to celebrities and movies and really people that are complicit in these exact things that we're fighting. You know, I always say, go right to the source. Like, if you know of a good nonprofit, if you know of a way that you can reach a survivor directly, please put your resources there. You know, we need more people resourcing a project like Relentless Hope and Cindy so she can keep doing this. You know, we need more of this. We need this to grow. the government's never going to provide the resources for these projects to get big. You know, we have to come together as a community and help resource each other, help promote each other. You know, there's way more of us than them, you guys. Like,
yes,
we can do this. We just have to come together. The only thing that they do better than us is organize. That's it. And like, we're starting to understand that. And piece by piece, we're coming together. And I really feel like Relentless Hope is a big piece of the heart of this puzzle, to where this is a way that we can all connect, that we can all take action, that we can all take this model and bring it to our own state, you know, and problem solve grassroots, like come together and do it together. We can come to law enforcement when we have everything, you know, and show them that we don't need them, that we can do the FBI and the CIA's work for them. They're out trafficking kids. So we're going to take on their job, you know, and I love that you're doing it yourself, Cindy. You're a little ninja going out there. But like I said, I get so many people that constantly ask me, what can I do? Please go contact Cindy, you guys. Give her, let her know what you want to do. Like she said, there's so much opportunity available. And I'm sure she's met a lot of people in this field. If you guys have a passion or an idea, go take it to her. Maybe she could use it. If it's an online project, help with social media, help with blogging, videos, whatever it is. If you guys have talents that you're wanting to contribute, if you want to be a volunteer and help survivors, if that's on your heart, she's willing to explore that with you and potentially give you an opportunity to do that. So please eat that up. There's not a lot of good nonprofits or businesses that I would ever promote on my show. You guys know that I don't do this very often, where I bring on and promote organizations or nonprofits. And I am very on board with what Cindy is doing and with Relentless Hope. So you guys have my stamp of approval on what she's doing. And I encourage you guys to please go support, go donate, go get a hold of her, thank her even, go hype her, keep her going. There's a lot of people that are probably going to be coming after her as she gets bigger. So you got to get even louder than them and keep her going. Cindy, is there anything that we didn't cover today before we wrap it up?
That you've done an excellent job. You're so gracious. So I thank you for supporting us. And yeah, I'd love to stay in touch and give you updates, because we do have some big, big projects we're working on. So yeah, I would love to come back and tell your audience.
And we would cherish having you back anytime you want to come on. The platform's yours. You just let me know, girl. And yes, there's so many things my mind's spinning. I'm like, I want to work with you somehow. I think we're all meeting, like we're all creating this puzzle together. So of course, yes, we'll keep in touch, and I would love to have you back. I know the audience would too. But thank you so much for coming on and for sharing, for putting that amazing presentation together. Thank you for your passion. And I just wish you the absolute best. I wish everybody, I ask you all to please keep your prayers over Cindy, over her family, over her organization, over all her workers. We need her to keep going. And I really believe in the power of prayer. And I think if we can pray over her, pray for the right people to reach her, for her to reach the right people, you know, this has the potential to be something incredible. It already is. But I just see you're just dipping your toe in the water right now. There's so much more for you to do. So keep your prayers over Cindy, you guys. Go connect with her. I'll have her website in the show notes. So if you guys want to contact her, I'll put the contact page to you. I'll put that link directly there. No matter what platform you're on, it lights up like a hyperlink. So you just got to go in the show notes and just literally click it, and it'll take you right to her website. It's super easy peasy. So please go connect with her, you guys. I will have all my information as well in the show notes. Connect with me too. We really appreciate you guys so much. Cindy, God bless you and everything that you're doing. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you guys for listening. God bless you all. And we will see you next time.